Work. Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Tuesday, July 29th. I'm Dave Rabin. It's great to be with you. Got a good, important show for you today. If you are feeling overwhelmed by all the changes engineered by the Trump administration, you're not alone. It's meant to be overwhelming. It's the demolition derby, then some. Some examples, the takedown of USAID and the Department of Education, ongoing ICE raids, fundraising for NPR and PBS, tax cuts for the wealthy, defunding of Medicaid and medical research, the sustained attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion. The list is long, and it's growing. But in the environmental sphere, you might have missed the Environmental Protection Agency, also known as the EPA, proposed revoking of something called the endangerment finding. Sounds arcane, but it's the underpinning of a lot of the federal government's efforts to deal with climate change. And climate change is something that hits people of color particularly hard. And this comes in the wake of the hottest year ever, a massive wildfires and warming oceans fueling hurricanes. And joining us in a few minutes are two environmental justice advocates. But first, we'll talk with independent journalist and board member of the Society for Environmental Journalists, Rocky Kistner. Rocky Kistner, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, David, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, sir. And let's cut to the chase. What is the endangerment finding, and why is the EPA attempting to get rid of it?
So the endangerment finding is one of the most important tools that we have to fight climate change. It was authorized by the EPA in, I believe, 2006. The Supreme Court was later brought into a decision-making around it in terms of its legality, and agreed that essentially what it does is it regulates greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, the various gases that create a blanket over the planet and lock in heat. So it creates climate change, essentially, that has dramatic and devastating impacts on storms, and ocean sea level rise, human health issues that are exploding. And it really is, in my view, the most important story on the planet. So the endangerment finding has been used by the EPA to regulate things like tailpipe emissions from cars, things that contribute dramatically to climate change. And it's been fairly effective, but it's always been kind of in the sights of the fossil fuel industry and the politicians that do their bidding. So, you know, the new administration under Trump, EPA is, you know, this is one of the major goals, is to try to get rid of it. And there will be another legal fight ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a big fight. It's not surprising that this proposed change is coming out of the EPA. I mean, the EPA now is headed up by Liz Zeldin. If I'm pronouncing it correctly, if you could just give us a bit of a background on this guy. I mean, it's the fox guarding the chicken, whatever it's called, the chicken box, whatever the
hen house
blanket's called.
Yes. All of the above. Zeldin is a former congressman, a conservative congressman. I've forgotten what district he's from, but New York, maybe? Anyway, he is a very industry-friendly person who was selected, and he's come in, and some people thought he was sort of a moderate on some of these issues, but he's turned out to be a vociferous sort of right-wing ideologue on getting rid of not only laws and regulations around climate change, but also staffing at EPA. He's been really a hardliner, and it looks like he's just started. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to believe. Here we are, you know, in the summer. It feels like we've been at this for years. I guess in some ways we have because of Trump's first term, but they've only been in office for 6 months, and look what they've done.
Yeah, I mean, the quote from him on this attempt to get rid of the endangerment finding is, it's driving a dagger into the heart of the climate change religion.
Exactly. Right.
I mean, this is the person that's heading up an agency, created under Richard Nixon, I believe.
Exactly. No,
of all people, who had, arguably a lot of things going other than, corruption in the Vietnam War, et cetera. But I mean, it's the ironies are profound. So, if implemented, what does this revoking of the endangerment finding mean for people of color? I mean, particularly going to impact. And we should say that this is kind of a done deal. We'll get to that in a moment. But this is not just a proposal. This is going to happen, if I'm understanding correctly. Maybe you could touch on that, Rocky.
I mean, I'm sure there will be lawsuits filed against it by various environmental groups and human rights groups, basically, because of the impact it's going to have. I mean, it's essentially going to gut, major regulations to try to curtail these greenhouse gases that are, a huge threat to us going forward. I mean, scientists say if we don't really get serious about this now, we are looking at things like what happened in Texas, tenfold. And it's not too distant in the future that, if we keep burning fossil fuels, spewing their gases into the atmosphere, creating more and more heat trapping, pollution, we're going to be, in various tipping points that we won't be able to reverse. And that is the scariest part of all. And climate scientists are very worried because every time they look into it, it gets worse. It's just getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
And the impact if we want to talk about the Texas floods, that was a perfect example of the impact of climate change on people of not only people of color, but people who don't have the resources, and are living in trailer parks, next to a river. I mean, it totally decimated their homes and impacted them much worse than, I mean, certainly, the people in the camps, were impacted hugely, and it's a real travesty there. But, this is just an example of what's going to be happening more and more. Scientists are, in complete agreement about this. This is not a hoax. It's real. It's happening now, and it's getting worse by the day.
Right. And in addition to the government's action on this, you're not exactly happy with the media's coverage of environmental issues, in particular its analysis of the primary cause of climate change. If you could touch on that.
Sure. Yeah. I'm a co-founder of a Substack called Money Trail that is run with an executive editor, Elliot Nagin. And we did a story about 10 days ago that looked at the media coverage of the floods, the disaster in Texas along the Guadalupe River. And the media response to that immediately jumped in and, you know, why weren't there more alarms? And, you know, why weren't there more safeguards to keep this from happening? And which is fine, because that's the media's job to ferret out, you know, what resulted in this tragedy. But the main cause of climate change, the main cause of these floods, which is burning fossil fuels and creating the environment of an atmosphere that is, you know, filled with moisture. As it gets warmer, it gets more moisture, and there's more deluges, more flooding, more, you know, events like this where a river will rise 20 feet in a matter of hours, 20 feet. So you had the media started asking questions, but climate change was hardly even mentioned. The Washington Post, we looked at, you know, the articles that were done. They did a great job of reporting on aspects of the flood, but they didn't mention fossil fuels until about almost 2 weeks later after the flood happened, and which is kind of bizarre, you know, for a newspaper like the Washington Post has done stellar reporting on climate change, what causes it, fossil fuel industry to some extent they reported on, but in this case they didn't. And the New York Times also ran something like 30 stories and barely mentioned climate change at all. Fossil fuels. So, you know, it kind of raises the question of why is that?
Yep. I mean, it's terribly important. We're talking about more moisture being in the air. They're fueling, hyperventilating, if you will, these storms, and, you know, 130 people at least killed, you know, a lot of them kids, you know, that were in lodging that they should not have been in, but the whole thing wouldn't have occurred were it not for all the moisture, the increased moisture in the air because of climate change. I mean, it's an ongoing problem, and we're going to have to move on, but I appreciate you being with us. I've been speaking with Rocky Kistner.
So, Dave,
go ahead.
I should just slip in one thing. Along with not mentioning fossil fuels, the media didn't report at all on who was taking the money from the fossil fuel industry in Texas, like Senator Cruz and Abbott, the governor, you know, who are the top-ranked fossil fuel receivers of money from Congress. No discussion of that at all. And, you know, that's basically where, you know, our laws are formed by people who are influenced by the fossil fuel industry and in negative ways, you know, misinformation. And the media's job is to report on it. And unfortunately, in this particular case, they didn't.
Right. I mean, it could only remind one of, you know, reporting on what's going on with Gaza and the West Bank. I mean, these people are taking money and are afraid of AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, and there's so many other examples. We're just picking on two, but I mean, there's lots of examples about how our politics are bought off essentially by various interests.
Well, I like to think of it as in terms of, you know, if you have cancer, you know, you want to find out what's causing it. And, you know, it's sort of like not asking about smoking, you know, for somebody who's suffering from lung cancer. When you have a flood of this type, you know, what's causing it? Well, you know, we know at least 75% of climate change attributes are caused by greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels. And nobody questions it. And it's just, it's got to change.
Right. I mean, we're talking about something like, I think, 75% of greenhouse gases that are created by fossil fuels, and we're just not dealing with it.
Exactly.
We need to keep hammering on this. I appreciate you being with us. I've been speaking with independent journalist and board member of the Society for Environmental Journalists, Rocky Kistner. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for all you're doing.
Thanks, David.
Appreciate it. And joining us now are AJ Yuan, legislative coordinator for the nonprofit We Act for Environmental Justice, and Basav Sen, Climate Justice Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome, gentlemen. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting us to your show.
It's great having you. And we would really like callers to join in. This is Community Watch and Comment. We need your comments. We need your questions. 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. Please chime in and give us your thoughts, your questions. Gentlemen, if you could talk about your groups, why don't we start with Basav Sen? Just tell us about your organization and what you are about.
Yes, thank you. So the Institute for Policy Studies is a multi-issue progressive think tank that works on a wide range of issues, economic justice, peace and demilitarization, et cetera. And I run our small climate justice team, a lot of whose focus in recent years has been specifically on fighting the fossil fuel industry and false solutions promoted by the fossil fuel industry.
Wonderful.
We are members of the Climate Justice Alliance.
Wonderful. And IPS, the Institute for Policy Studies, was co-founded by Marcus Raskin, I believe, the father of Jamie Raskin, the congressman, and a wonderful organization in so many ways. Started out as anti-war in the 60s and has blossomed into so many various entities. And AJ Yuan, if you could talk about your organization, please.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, David. So I work at React for Environmental Justice. We're a West Harlem / Northern Manhattan-based membership-based organization. Our goal is really to make sure that we can build and live in healthy environments. And particularly, we want to make sure that people of color and people of low income can do so by actively participating in the policy-making process, this process that they've been historically left out of. So we've had a long track record of impacting legislation at the New York City and New York State level. In 2012, we opened an office here in D.C., and since then, we've really been trying to uplift and center environmental justice and federal environmental policy.
Wonderful. It's wonderful to see a young face on this program to counter the oldsters. it's wonderful having you. Let's take a step back and look at the underpinnings of environmental justice. Implications for climate justice affect everyone, but African Americans are particularly endangered. I was looking at a study that talks about half of African Americans in this country live in the Southeast, 11 states with exceptional vulnerability to heat, hurricanes, and flooding. I mean, that's what we just saw with Texas, what we saw with the hurricanes in the Carolinas. If you both could talk about that, why don't we go to Basav first?
Yes, and the problem runs even deeper. Black communities and other communities of color, like indigenous communities, are systematically targeted as sacrifice zones by the fossil fuel industry and by other related polluting industries, such as plastics and petrochemicals. One of the most glaring examples is this region in Louisiana that has earned the name Cancer Alley because of its disproportionately high rates of cancer. And it's an area predominantly inhabited by lower income Black folks. And the polluting industries are located in these communities precisely because they do not have the political power to fight back, precisely because they are politically marginalized. Not only are these communities poisoned by the various emissions from these industrial facilities, which include cancer-causing volatile organic compounds and smog-forming, nitrogen oxides and particulate matter and so on, but also the greenhouse gas emissions from these facilities that are fueling climate change also end up disproportionately impacting these same communities again and again. Partly that is because of geography, because, for instance, as you pointed out, in much of the Southeast, there's a disproportionately large Black population, or, for example, in the Permian Basin region in western Texas and southeastern New Mexico, disproportionately you have Latinx and indigenous folks who are living there. Those are regions that are repeatedly hit by storms in the Gulf Coast area or by drought and wildfires in places like New Mexico. But also on a micro scale, you find that even within a particular community, because of zoning patterns, because of property values, etc., it is the most marginalized communities who end up, for instance, living in the floodplain because that's where they can afford to live. So both on a macro and a micro scale, you find that climate change, as well as other forms of pollution attributable to the fossil fuel industry, disproportionately harm communities of color.
Yeah. I mean, one fact that was startling for me in preparing for this program, Black Americans will be exposed to extreme heat 38 days a year compared to 27 days for white Americans. I mean, there's disproportionate impact for sure. AJ, you on, if you could give us your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, decades of research has shown that it's people of color and people of low income who are most affected by environmental pollution. And like Abhasav was saying, it's we always say that these communities are overburdened and underinvested. So when the administration or Congress are attacking environmental justice, calling it DEI, calling it waste, fraud, and abuse, that's completely wrong. These communities have been suffering for decades. They're finally getting the funding and the help and the capacity they needed to address, environmental justice impacts, the funding that, and I'm maybe skipping ahead a little bit, but the funding that happened during the Biden-Harris administration, the rulemakings that came out, all these things were helping to finally address this environmental injustice.
I mean, another factoid that I ran across, Black Americans in the Southeast almost two times as likely to be affected by hurricanes. And going back to what Rocky Kistner was talking about, I mean, and he's still with us. If he wants to chime in, please do. But I mean, we're not getting, I don't recall, I'm not watching much television, if at all, but I don't recall on the radio or elsewhere much information about the differentiation between, people of color and others in the Southeast, in terms of the hurricanes and such. Maybe if Rocky Kistner wants to chime in, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely right. And, you know, there's hardly any coverage on national television on climate at all, even on, you know, people from disadvantaged communities, the impact, which is much, much higher. I think there was a recent study that came out by Media Matters last year, showed less than 10% of the stories about climate change, mentioning fossil fuels and the whole issue of emissions. It's just a professional lack of doing your due diligence and duty as a reporter if you don't mention what's causing this. And the national media, you know, has for some reason a hard time doing it. And, you know, there certainly are a lot of concerns that the advertising industry, fossil fuel industry, has an impact on that. It's hard to imagine it doesn't. But, CNN is one of the few national networks that has a climate reporter, Bill Weir, who does generally a good job. But, you know, one reporter out of, you know, of all the television networks, I mean, it's just pretty astounding.
Yeah. So glad you're staying with us, Rocky Kistner. We have a couple of callers. It's so great to hear from you. We need more. 202-588-0893. The first caller, if you care to give your name, where you're calling from, and your question or comment.
This is Rick calling you long distance from Germany, man.
Oh, fantastic. I love it. International. That's fantastic.
My question is to your guests, any of them who care to answer, do you know what is going to happen in the next 30 years when both of the poles, the North and South Pole, have completely melted?
Yeah, I mean, it's a crucial question. Got three wonderful guests. So who wants to grab that one?
So I can start and others can follow. I do not believe that the complete melting of both the poles is inevitable now. Though I do think that if we keep on business as usual for several more years, we will have reached that tipping point and it will at that point become inevitable. But to me, what that does is underlines the urgency of compelling institutions who have the power to do so to act quickly. And that means powerful governments as well as the fossil fuel industry and the rest of the private sector who are enablers of the fossil fuel industry, namely the financial institutions who loan them capital or provide them insurance or the computer and software service providers to the fossil fuel industry, who include some big players such as Amazon's cloud operation, et cetera. And I would say that all of them are complicit in runaway climate change right now, and the threat to the poles and what that would do to sea levels and to communities along the coasts worldwide is a compelling argument for why we should force all of these institutions to change course.
Right. I mean, and you have to think, given the current regime running our country, it's not likely to happen without a big uprising from the populace, which we hope we're contributing to any other thoughts from my two other guests?
Yeah, I could just say that I think it's absolutely right that the melting of both poles this century is quite unlikely. If that were to happen, it would be more than catastrophic. It would be the end of many coastal cities around the world. If and when that happens, it will be something we've never witnessed before. But I can say that our Arctic, which is melting faster than anywhere else on the planet, is expected to be ice-free in the summer in the coming decades. And that will result in a tipping point of sorts, because ice is, of course, white and reflective and reflects the sun. But when the ocean, if the ice melts, the ocean becomes an absorber of heat. And that just compounds the problem, and it just makes things warmer and warmer and warmer. And already in the Antarctic, which until just maybe 10 years ago or so, people thought was fairly stable, we're now finding, scientists are finding huge melting issues of major glaciers that will have dramatic impacts on coastal cities, by the end of the century. So this is an ongoing problem now, and it's only going to get worse, and we need to stop burning fossil fuels.
Yeah, and we should say that the United States is, the second largest emitter of greenhouse gases. I mean, we're not idle observers of this phenomena. We're very deeply responsible. AJ, you on any thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, just stressing that, our planet is very interconnected, and even if just the ice caps, even if ice around the poles is starting to melt more, like that impacts the entire globe, right? All that energy, all that heat will impact weather systems across the Earth. And extreme weather gets worse everywhere, right? It's not just on the coast, but it's hurricanes, it's droughts with changing weather patterns, everything.
Yeah. I believe we have another caller. It's so great that people are chiming in. Keep it up. We want to hear from folks. This is Community Watch and Comment, and we need your comments. Your caller, and if you could give your name and where you're calling from, if you wish, and your question or comment.
Sure, if I'm on. This is Alan from D.C.
Great.
And I have a question generally about the issue of environmental justice or environmental equity. As a historian of environmental policy, I was somewhat dismayed when I first came across people talking about environmental equity in terms of disadvantaged individual populations. Historical knowledge is that the reason we got environmental protection passed as legislation in the first place is because it was an environmental equity issue. Hold on a second. There's a tape delay, and I'm hearing myself on the radio. Hold on. Okay, I can think clearer now.
That could ruin your whole day.
Well, so, the problem with calling impacts on individual populations an environmental equity issue is that the whole enterprise of environmental protection is actually an environmental equity issue. If it weren't for the equitable issue of saying that industries are polluting the whole environment, and that means that some small groups of people are impacting large groups of people negatively, if it weren't for that, we never would have had legislation. And my problem, I don't have any issue with the fact that some groups now are more impacted than others. But I think the way we need to think about it is that it's a two-tiered issue. And this is what needs to be communicated, is that generally environmental protection is an equity issue. And then as a second-tier issue, some parties are impacted more specifically. Now, the reason this is important is because you know, if you talk about environmental equity and you don't also articulate the general thing that environmental protection is the whole of the population versus some small population, if you don't talk about it in that, in those terms also, that also is an equity issue, then you diminish the scope of the equity issue. You diminish the political power. I know that's a lot of words, but I
got you. Any thoughts on this from my esteemed guests? You don't all have to chime in, but if you have any reaction, we're talking about it. It reminds me kind of about Roosevelt in the New Deal saying that this is a broad issue. It's not just about specific groups. Sometimes we might miss that. Any thoughts about that, gentlemen?
Yeah, I think the reason why we focus on the impacts that are disproportionately impacting people of color and people of low income first is because the impacts of pollution and climate change hurt these communities first and worst. And that's why we want to put a focus on uplifting communities that have had it worse than other communities over the past few decades. And I'll just say, I think most people across America actually do recognize this and do understand this. There was a poll by the Environmental Protection Network that came out after the election that showed that 80% of American voters supported increasing federal funding to communities disproportionately harmed by air and water pollution. So I think justice is an issue that most folks can understand and get around. And I definitely understand what the caller was saying about, environmental protection in general is an equity issue. But I will say, I think it is really critical and important to uplift the people who are suffering first and foremost.
So quickly following up on that, to me, this is not an either or, it's a yes and. Yes, it is true that environmental pollution and climate change hurts everyone, and it's being perpetrated by a small minority, industry and people who derive their wealth from these industries. But also, both from the standpoint of the underlying cause of the problem and the standpoint of how to address it in a just manner, it is very important to focus on these disparities of race and class. First of all, because we have known about climate change for, at this point, well more than 100 years. This Swedish chemist named Arrhenius won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1907 for his explanation of the heat-trapping properties of carbon dioxide. Now, I would argue that a big reason that nation-states and corporations have not addressed this issue is precisely because they found that the people who were being hurt the most were marginalized people who they didn't care about. So, for instance, here in the U.S., the first major congressional hearing about climate change was in 1965, 60 years ago. And the United States has failed to act for 60 years precisely because for much of that time, they saw these impacts as likely to happen to marginalized people who they didn't care about. And so in a way, these racial and economic inequities are fundamental to the story of why this country and the global system has failed to address climate change on an expedited basis, because even globally, we find that it's countries in the global south, such as Pacific Islands, who are disproportionately impacted by climate change.
Yeah, I want to move on because we're running out of time. I should say that I'm speaking with AJ Yuan, Legislative Coordinator for WE Act for Environmental Justice. And you just heard from Basav Sen, Climate Justice Project Director at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're also joined by Rocket Kistner Society for Environmental journalists, and we would love to hear from callers, as I've been saying, 202-588-0893. AJ Yuan, if you could talk about how the priorities of our government are reflected in the proposed federal budgets for 2026. If you could touch on that, it gives us a blueprint for where we're going with this, or where we're more specifically not going with this.
Yeah, sure. So currently what's happening in Congress is right now is that they're trying to pass appropriations bills. So these are the government funding bills that fund the different agencies and programs across the federal government. So EPA, Department of Interior, stuff like that. So on July 22nd, the House Appropriations Committee advanced their version of the fiscal year 2026 Interior Environment Bill. So this would fund the agencies, Department of Interior, Environmental Protection Agency, and other related agencies. And the House version is pretty disastrous. It would cut EPA's EJ funding 100%. I believe that's $100 million. It would also cut money to implement a number of critical Biden-era rulemakings that protected human health. So rules that were regulating pollution from power plants, from vehicles, methane emissions, stuff like that. So the Senate version was passed on July 24th, advanced from the Senate Appropriations Committee on July 24th. And the Senate version was negotiated in a more bipartisan manner between Democrats and Republicans. So the cuts are not as egregious. However, there still is a 60% cut to EPA's EJ funding. And I just want to uplift like that funding from the Inflation Reduction Act, from the bipartisan infrastructure law that went to EJ communities was transformational. It was critical. It was life-saving. These are grants and funding that addressed air pollution in schools, right, in fence line communities. It was funding that would go to electric vehicle stations and addressing water pollution, addressing pollution in safe drinking water, like all this funding is critical. So any kind of rollback, any kind of attack in these appropriations bills is going to be disastrous, especially for those EJ communities that suffer first numbers.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, the administration is following through on what Trump campaigned on, drill, baby, drill. Rocket Kistner and Balsab Sen, what do you think? I mean, the American population is getting what they voted for. This guy, Mr. Trump, won the election handily. Not a mandate for sure, but all the swing states went his way, and the American public is getting what it voted for. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are that they're not getting what they voted for. I think, yes, it's true that a lot of people are supporters of the oil and gas industry, or particularly those who work in oil and gas. But most people, if you look at some of the polls that have come out in recent years, a vast majority of people want clean energy. They want jobs in solar. They want jobs in wind. They don't want more drilling. Look what happened, in the Gulf. Katrina blew in, but you had the BP oil disaster that was the worst disaster in history in the United States. So nobody wants that. I think it's boils down to kind of a communication issue, because there's been a great improvement in the wind and solar and renewable energy sector to get its message across. It is actually cheaper than fossil fuels in most cases. And, a lot of the arguments that the fossil fuel industry has are no longer valid because the technology has changed. And that's a good thing. But unfortunately, the oil and gas industry has a lot more money, and they can, pour it into advertising and misinformation campaigns. And, drill, baby, drill becomes you know, something that the Trump campaign latched onto. But I think, you know, I mean, I'm not a pollster, but I follow him. And if you look at some of the polls recently, they support clean energy and are worried about climate change. So Trump is not giving people what they want.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. The fossil fuel industry is actually really unpopular. Big oil billionaires are unpopular, along with all billionaires, honestly. There is, you know, a wide degree of resentment at the kind of economic polarization that has happened in this country. And we must always remember that turnout in U.S. elections is actually not very high. You must look at the large percentage of people who don't vote, and it's very easy to dismiss them as, oh, they are apathetic, but that isn't necessarily the case. Many of them probably just don't feel compelled to vote because they don't feel that the political system represents their interests and that it's, you know, weighted towards wealthy people who can buy influence. And as Rocky was pointing out, even though if it were actually left to market forces, renewable energy would outcompete fossil fuels today, the fossil fuel industry, just with its financial clout, has been able to buy off our political system to perpetuate its existence. And that also goes to, I think, a core failure of the Biden administration, who thought they could address climate change by subsidizing renewable energy and, you know, home electrification and things like that, and hope that that would outcompete and beat the fossil fuel industry, while at the same time they were handing out permits to the fossil fuel industry, particularly for liquefied natural gas exports.
Right.
And also for drilling on public lands and so on.
Right.
And that was a mistake. Really, in addition to subsidizing renewable energy, the government needs to stand up to the fossil fuel industry by freezing these permits and ending the exports of oil and gas.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the contradictory movements, doing one thing with one hand and the other with your other hand. We have another caller. It's wonderful you're checking in, your name, where you're calling from, and if you would, and your question or comment.
Is that me?
Hi, you're on the air. Thank you for checking in.
What I wanted to find out is, you haven't mentioned anything about nuclear energy. I disagree that nuclear energy is clean energy, but there are those that are trying to frame nuclear energy as clean energy. And what is your thoughts on that? And then on another note, I think that the other caller was implicitly saying that because of the racism, then you have to frame the environmental justice as, you know, affecting everybody because of the racism, the people won't support helping African Americans or other people of color in this country, or even low income people. Thank you.
Right. Thank you so much for checking in, gentlemen. We're real quickly. We're running out of time. If you could give us your thoughts on our caller's comments.
I can jump in.
Go ahead. Just
quickly, nuclear energy is a huge controversy. You know, the technology still doesn't exist to do it financially, you know, in a financial competitive way. Not, you know, discarding the waste issue, which is still a big problem, and the arms issue that could evolve. But I think scientists are split on this because they feel that without some major, you know, non-emission source of energy that is, you know, it's going to be difficult to turn the tide, and we're losing time. And so we'll see what, if the technology can improve to a point where it's feasible, but right now it's not.
Yeah.
So quick addition to that, nuclear energy is also unjust and toxic. If you look at the entire life cycle of nuclear energy from uranium mining through processing into fuel, through the reactors, through the waste disposal, you know, at every stage, it is marginalized communities who are impacted. And you particularly have to look at places in the Southwest, like in New Mexico, where indigenous communities have been treated as sacrificial for uranium mining. And also, it is extremely slow to build. And honestly, we don't have that kind of time. Building a nuclear reactor is an extremely complex construction project. And on the timeline that we need to address climate change, you know, we can install way more solar and wind energy in much less time. And that's what we need to focus on instead.
Yeah. Hey, Jake, any thoughts?
I mean, Rocky and also, I think, hit it on all of it, but I'll just say we really cannot replace like a fossil fuel sacrifice system with the clean energy sacrifice system. Like all these things are going have impacts no matter what. We can't just replace the impacts that communities of color are facing from fossil fuels with the mining or the construction of nuclear power plants.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I do want to bring up the fact that the International Court of Justice, the United Nations top court, issued an advisory opinion. Advisory is a very important adjective here. Recently, they found that all nations must tackle climate change, and those that do not act could be obliged to pay reparations for the harm caused to the environment. We just have a couple of minutes left, but I'd love to hear your thoughts, gentlemen, on International Court of Justice advisory opinion. Why don't we go to Rocky first and go around the table, and we'll end up just very quickly. We have a couple of minutes left.
I'll just go ahead and let let the others comment on it, because I'm not all that familiar with it.
Excellent. Basav, any thoughts on the court's decision?
Yes, even though it's symbolic and not enforceable, regardless, it's great news because it gives argument to our side in legal processes within countries as well.
And AJ, you on any thoughts on this?
Yeah, again, not an expert on the ruling, but I will say I think this is really demonstrating how the countries across the globe are really taking on the leadership of addressing climate change and how far behind America is, how we really need to step up and follow the lead of countries across the globe.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a wonderful moment. The case was initiated by what South Pacific law students, whose lands are totally threatened by a global warming, and 6 years later, and it surprised a lot of people. The International Court of Justice ruled in their favor. It is advisory, but it's something that gives momentum, I think we can say, to the whole movement. We're going to have to end it there. I've been speaking with AJ Yuan, legislative coordinator for the nonprofit We Act for Environmental Justice, and Basav Sen, a climate justice project director for another nonprofit, Institute for Policy Studies, a wonderful organization that does so many things. And we've also been joined by Rocky Kistner. I'm so glad you stayed on for the whole show. It's great to have you from the Society for Environmental Journalists. That's going to do it for our show. Thanks to our wonderful engineer for getting us through the show. And coming up, don't forget the blues with the fabulous Lady Murr. And check out David Whetstone's program, tomorrow at the same hour. I'm sure he will have something that will draw you in. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dave Rabin. Stay safe and have a good week.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world one broadcast at a time.
African Diaspora International Film Festival, Africa World Now Project, and GWU Africana Studies Program present the 18th Annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C., August 1st to the 3rd, featuring a film on Walter Rodney, films on Black musical traditions, and more. Receptions and Q&As, ADIFFDC, from August 1st to the 3rd at the GWU Student Center. Tickets and schedule at NYADIFF.org or at 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black Life Matters. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
I'm Janelle Anderson. I've been listening to WPFW since the 80s. It has helped manage my lifestyle in that listening to health programs turned me away from the hormone antibiotic meats. I've been a pescatarian since I had my girls listen to WPFW on the way to school, in that I believe they became organizers for justice. One co-founded a justice club in her high school, and another helped organize demonstrations. And I think today they are the better for just listening to those morning programs. I love the diverse format, from jazz to inspirational to talk. The programming has really grown me, and for those reasons and more, I support WPFW.
Greetings. This is Papa Wabe inviting you to check out my new showgram, Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, every Thursday morning from 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We present a mashup of positive, uplifting music of different genres, mainly roots reggae. We also feature poetry, speeches, artist interviews, and so much more. That's Free Your Mind with Papa Wabe, Thursday mornings, 2 to 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on WPFW 89.3 FM, making it a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Free your mind!
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly five decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call